This is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as a thank you for your support of On Your Money during the recently concluded fall membership drive, this entire hour is for you and your personal finance questions. So if you have one, call us 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let me welcome Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Today, Kevin is in our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
This is a very special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. As promised, because we reached our goal, we are thanking listeners with this entire hour for their questions. We had a goal of, if I'm not mistaken, 500 pledges for the two episodes of On Your Money during the fall membership drive. More than 600 pledges were gained during the fall membership drive. So we exceeded the goal, Kevin. Thanks, I'm sure, in part to your mini money booklet on college costs.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm sure several of you pledged to get the mini money booklet covering college costs. Some of you pledged to support the show. Some of you pledged to support just Wisconsin Public Radio in general. And some of you pledged so we would stop talking about it. And those of you who are in the latter category are going to be disappointed for just a few more minutes. any dollar amount. And we like that because not only does it give people of any means or any interest in pledging a chance to show their support in a way, but then they get something for it. And it costs Wisconsin Public Radio little to nothing other than the person power to send it out to them via email or via regular mail. So, yeah, thank you very much for all of your support. We're always humbled by it, and we really appreciate all listeners alone, but especially those people who take the time to demonstrate their support in a little more tangible terms.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you. And why don't we start with a quick question from Santiago, who says that he listened to both of the On Your Money fall membership drive shows online, but wasn't able to get a copy of the mini money booklet because the show wasn't live. Is there any way we can help him and others like him?
Do we have proof that Santiago actually did listen to the show? Because a lot of people say, like my wife says she listens to the show, and then I'll mention something about it, and I said, wow, wasn't that something when the elephant broke into the studio right in the middle of the show? And she said, oh, yeah, that was funny. And I said, she didn't actually listen to
the show. We need to have a videotape or something.
We have some kind of cast. If you send an email, Santiago and others like you, to onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org, your information will be forwarded along to the Pledge Drive membership department, and then you'll be contacted with more questions, and then you can have the information emailed to you. Remember, this covering college cost is not just for people on the cusp of college, but for parents, grandparents, whomever thinking about having a baby. You might want to think about trying to save for that kid's college, or if you're already out of school and you're trying to figure out how to pay off those student loans, we may be able to help you as well.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have a question for Kevin. You can also email your question on onyourmoney@wpr.org. And I know, Kevin, that you did go through the On Your Money email bag and have a number of emailed questions that we'll get to during this hour. And one of them, and it's a common subject that many of our listeners ask about at this time of year, is about health savings accounts, or HSAs. Most listeners are apprehensive about using these health savings accounts. Do you feel the same way?
I'm not apprehensive, but I do understand why people would feel kind of nervous about going to them and not be crazy about it when their employer offers them for the first time out. Basically, what these are is, you first of all, you're offered or you decide to choose, if you have that choice, a high deductible health insurance plan, and then it's paired with a health savings account. Now, you do get lower premiums generally because you're shouldering more of the burden of the cost in the form of the higher deductible. And then you make pre-tax contributions to the HSA, the health savings account, and some employers do kick a little bit in there extra as well. When it's your turn to pay for some of the deductible, your share of the deductible, you can pull tax-free money out of that HSA when you need to do so.
What if you don't use up all the money that's in the health savings account?
Well, it's unlike, you know, one of the most unfortunate things about this arrangement is they termed it an HSA, which sounds a lot like an FSA, a flexible spending account. That actually is a use it or lose it proposition, but the HSA is not a use it or lose it proposition. The money rolls over if you don't use it from year to year, goes into the next year's account, the next year afterward to pay for future qualified expenses, and as you get older, if you want to, you can use the money tax-free to pay for future long-term care, health insurance, healthcare premiums, whatever you're looking to spend in the future. And then when you turn 65, the distributions out of the account are taxable. You can pull the money out for any reason at that time without any penalty. They're taxable as income but with no penalties, just like an IRA. So it kind of becomes almost an ersatz retirement savings account for you if there is money left over.
Well, so is everybody a good candidate for using a health savings account?
Well, sadly, that's a good way to put that because soon everybody will have these types of accounts. But for, if you have the option, you're trying to decide if you should take it. Typically, those on either end of the income and wealth spectrum are prime candidates for it. If you're lower income and you're trying to decide, should I save for retirement or should I save via an HSA, you might actually be better off using the HSA and the high deductible plan because you'll pay lower premiums if you are responsible for the premium cost for the health insurance. And whatever money you don't need to pay the deductible, again, becomes a retirement account for you when you reach 65, for better or for worse. In the upper income brackets, especially if you're already maxing out your retirement savings options, like in a pre-tax plan like a 401k or 403b, you get further tax deductions on the contributions. And like all high deductible plans, when it comes to insurance, these are better for people who are unlikely to need them. So the better health you are in and unlikely to use it, the better it is to accept lower premiums and the possibility of paying more out of pocket for the deductible.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. He does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, let's get to some questions for you, Kevin. Our lines are full at the moment. Rachel in Richland Center has a question for you. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling. What's your question?
So mine's a little bit different than investments. I have a question about credit cards, if I could. I received an offer in the mail to get a credit card, no annual fee, but then you get like two free airline tickets and all of these special things. And I'm wondering if those are worth it or if there's a problem with getting a credit card just for the reason of getting some free airline tickets, if that's bad for your credit score or bad for your background and things.
Hmm. Kevin?
Well, Rachel, we don't judge here, first of all. So, second of all, it's a great question. And a lot of people I know who manage their credit and their debt very responsibly use these kinds of cards, in part because the credit card companies are going to get you one way or the other. The question is the way you are going to behave with the credit card is the way that they're going to take advantage of you. And if you say, I'm just going to get this card and I'm going to charge it for groceries and gas and all these other things, and then I'm going to pay it off right away, they typically, the credit card company loses out, especially if they offer fairly generous terms on the miles, which some do. Capital One is actually a company which has a good reputation of offering the best mileage programs out there, but the best cards are the hardest ones to get. Where people get in trouble for this is they say, well, I'm going to get this, and then I promise I'm going to pay it off, and then they go, oh, well, shoot, not this month, but definitely next month, and then the month after that, well, shoot, now I'm carrying a balance, and then I'm going up and over, and I'm hurting my credit rating. So if you can promise yourself that you're going to pay it off every single month and only use it to build up the miles, it's a really good deal. If you think that you might fall prey to the credit card company's tactics of luring you in with these miles and then charging up too much to pay off in a given month, you're probably better off just finding a card more appropriate for your situation and not worrying so much about the miles.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck, Rachel. Boy, yeah, and then you have to try to use the miles once you rack them up, Kevin, which isn't always done easily.
No, especially not in this time when vacation is practically forbidden. Even if you have the vacation, you can't take it because there'll be so much work when you get back, or you're kind of, yeah, you go ahead, take your vacation if you must, and it's legally mandated. But and then trying to use it at a time, you know, over the holidays or spring break or whatever, obviously the planes are booked up, and so it's harder to utilize those miles at that time.
That's my resolution, though, for this coming year. I've got actually a couple of cards that I have all these free miles on, and I'm going to try to cash some of those in, see if I can use them. Ray in Superior is with us next. Hi, Ray.
Hello. Yeah, I've got a question. As far as money market, we've got a substantial amount of money in the money market. It's making zero. Do you see the money market starting to pay here in the, oh, let's say, the near future?
The money market?
Right.
Money market accounts, like it's a common complaint. There are trillions of dollars sitting right now in very safe or relatively safe accounts that pay nothing. And the reason is because due to central bank action and demand throughout the world for safe money, they've driven prices up, which drives interest rates down to virtually nothing. A couple different ways around it. First of all, Ray, one question I would ask is, do you really need a higher rate of return, and should you take more risk? And many times people are conditioned to always trying to search for a higher rate of return, and in doing so, take on a lot more risk than either what they understand or what they need to accomplish their longer-term goals. So if you're comfortable with risk, you can use bond funds or bonds or even stock funds. But understand that you could lose in a very short period of time 10 to 20 to 30% of your money while you're trying to get maybe 1 to 2 to 3% more than what these very safe and liquid investments pay. If you would prefer to keep it an err on the side of caution and keep it safe, I'd much rather have you look at certificates of deposit with very long terms of maturity, because you're generally going to get the higher rate of return by going out further, as long as you pay attention to the substantial penalties for early withdrawal. And you can go to a place like Bankrate. .com has a shopping service for CDs, and Google.com has them as well now. And you can find usually about 1.5% to 2% around the country if you're willing to go out for a longer time. And again, pay close attention to the terms. Another one of our favorite investments for people in search of a slightly higher yield with relatively little risk are Series I savings bonds. And you can go to treasurydirect.gov to find out how to purchase those. Those pay about 2.2% right now, but on November 1st, they're going to announce a new interest rate. Depending on inflation, you're probably going to see that in the roughly the same range. But we'll have links to all these websites up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Thanks very much, Ray. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. And this is an all questions answered edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.
You're the tops. You're the Coliseum. You're the top. You're a museum.
You are the tops. Thanks very, very much for all of your support during our recently concluded fall membership drive and all of the support of On Your Money. More than 600 pledges came in during On Your Money, and we could not do this without you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, who promised that for all of that support that we would devote this entire hour to answering as many listener questions as possible. If you have one for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Amy writes and says, when I was in middle school or so, I was fortunate enough to have my mom start up a Roth IRA for me. Over the years, I've contributed as much as I could of the $5,000 a year. However, I've been noticing a 5.75% sales charge for each time I submit my money. Is this a regular charge with IRAs, or should I look for a different IRA? Kevin?
Well, first, congratulations to Amy's mom for having the wherewithal to put money aside for a working teen. We're going to just be discussing later on why this is such a good idea. And as part of the demonstration of why this is such a good idea, we have Amy, who has taken up the task, if you will, of saving for her own retirement, because her mother not only talked the talk about saving money, but also walked the walk by making the contribution herself. So good for Amy's mother, and good for Amy for doing that. And again, we will be talking about the advantages of making such a move in a few weeks.
Yeah, good for Amy and Amy's mom. Way to go. But what is this sales charge all about?
It's not on IRAs specifically. Remember, IRAs and Roth IRAs are basically jars or vessels that are empty, and you can put money into it, and then once the money is within these vessels or jars, you can buy just about whatever kind of paper investment you might like. The sales charge, the 5.75%, is on the mutual fund that is being chosen for Amy, or perhaps she chose herself. It's a front-end sales charge. These are more commonly known as A sales charges, to differentiate them from B and C sales charges, which charge a little differently, more either on your going ongoing deposits or on the back end of it. But let's say Amy puts $1,000 into this front end charge mutual fund with 5.75% and buys shares of it. That's a $57.50 charge up front that she loses right away. She'll never be charged that again, but that's gone. So if she sells it, that money will never come back to her. Out of that $57, about $20 goes to the advisor, about $30 goes to the advisor's firm typically, and then a few bucks go to the mutual fund company basically for providing the service and the transaction cost.
So should she be concerned about this charge at all?
If she feels like she's getting something for it from any of these different parties, no, she shouldn't be concerned about it at all. Whether if she's getting, you know, good advice from the advisor or help from the firm, if she can call the advisor's assistant, ask a tax question, or you know, get some money out of this or whatever, that's probably worth it. And she is the decider if it's worth it or not. So if it is, she can continue to use this particular fund and this particular advisor and keep paying it if she wants to. She may want to check with the advisor and say, I don't feel like I'm getting what I'm paying for. Is there a different way we can still work together, but you can get paid, but I can get help in a different form, or pay for your services in a different way?
And if she decides the fee's not worth it?
She has more decisions, but she generally has good options. She can move to another firm with another advisor, but then keep in mind, she's probably going to have to pay that advisor some way or another through some form of fee. Or, and especially for Amy's case, where these are, you know, a few $1,000 deposits a year, maybe she may want to do it on her own and go to a firm like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity, TIA Cref, TD Ameritrade. All these companies are basically platforms that allow people just like Amy to make these deposits, still get a little help, and they'll probably charge some fees. You might, you know, say, hey, we're going to charge you $10 or $20 to make a trade or something, but they won't be quite as high, especially on a percentage basis, for larger deposits. So, and they still do offer some help. Generally, it's closer to the level of a call center than an individual, but they will offer help. They're not just going to leave her hanging. They might offer some guidance, and the websites are very intuitive as well. So she might want to check those out on her own. And I have confidence if she has the discipline enough to keep saving through her, you know, teen and young adult years, she also has enough ability to manage this on her own as well.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Joe in Franklin. Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Joy. Kevin, pardon my voice. A quick comment, if I may, about a couple of things that Kevin talked about earlier, and then the question. Number one, regarding airline miles, you're probably better off getting a card like Capital One, or I use American Express, where you can buy your ticket on your own anytime, anywhere, and then get a statement credit rather than going through a dedicated card to an airline, because seats are never available.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, Joe. You sound like you know what you're talking about. So, yes, that's correct.
Secondly, regarding HSAs, you said you can withdraw after age 65 on a taxable basis, but I presume that if it's for medical expenses, it's still non-taxable?
Correct. If they are for qualified expenses, and that definition probably will change over time. Some things will come in, some things will be left out. But yes, usually you can pull it out tax-free for qualified medical expenses, or you can pull it out, do whatever you want with it after 65, but it will be taxed as ordinary income, just like it were a withdrawal from an IRA.
Okay, my question real quick. I'm planning to retire. I'm going to wait till I'm 64 to pull Social Security, which is in a couple of months. I have enough in my pension, Social Security, to live on, and I want to leave my 401k intact. The required minimum distribution, if I use my 401k as essentially a savings account and pull out clumps of money, will that satisfy in some way, shape, or form the minimum withdrawal?
Well, the required minimum withdrawal, as you know, probably know, does not kick in until you're 70 and a half. And what they do is they just basically look at the balance of the account when you, it's actually April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. But they look at the IRS looks at the balance of the account and says, okay, there's $100,000 in there. Based on your age, you have to pull out at least, let's say, $3,000. That's when the RMD hits. Otherwise, you can pull out whenever you want, whatever you want. It's only until after you turn 70 and a half when the actual RMD kicks in. And again, it's only on the balance at that time. So taking a little bit out now does increase your taxation, increases your income as well. But it does, in theory, reduce the amount that you would have to pull out from an RMD. But again, you probably want to kick that can down the road as far as you can, because for most people, even with a pension and Social Security, you're probably going to be taxed higher on it if you pile it on right now than you would be if you were to wait 4 or 5 years down the road when the tax brackets are likely to be a little higher at the different levels.
Thanks very much, Joe. Take care of that scratchy throat. Robert in Appleton is with us. Hello, Robert.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about 529s. We have accounts for our grandchildren. I recently saw, I think in the Wall Street Journal, that although assets are not considered from a 529, the year after a distribution is made, the student is required to report this as untaxed resources, and it has a significant impact on financial aid. First, part of the question is that true, and what is the level of impact? And second, how do we get around that?
It is true. It depends on the institution in question and the child in question. And keep in mind, we are talking about need-based aid, not merit aid. So the 529 distributions from a grandparent do not hurt the child's need-based aid, and they do not affect the family's expected contribution in the year in which you help them out. It's the next year. And the schools, quite frankly, are right to do this, because they're saying, hey, no offense, great that you saved this money for college, but you obviously saved this money for college. So this is technically resources devoted to that. If you want to get around that, you're going to be hit for it in the year following the year you make that type of distribution. It's still tax-free, but it might affect the aid. And generally what they'll probably do is count somewhere from a third to a half of whatever the distribution was back into the expected family contribution. So if you took a $10,000 distribution to help your grandchild, which is very noble and a very good thing to do, they might add, let's say, I don't know, $2,000 to $5,000 back into the expected family contribution for next year's use. One way to avoid that is to reserve the 529 assets for as long as you possibly can into the child's education schedule, meaning waiting until the kid is at least a junior and maybe a senior in college, because if they're not applying for financial aid because they're hopefully graduating in subsequent years, the distribution won't show up. And obviously if they're going to have to law school, med school, grad school, whatever in the next year, then it will show up. But otherwise, generally most need-based aid comes in the form of loans anyway, subsidized loans. So there, in most schools, for most kids anyway, there aren't a bunch of free dollars just lying around waiting to be grabbed, and especially on a need basis. So that's about the only way you can avoid it if you want to. But otherwise, is to kind of push it out as far as you possibly can, Robert.
Thanks very much, Robert, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. And this is a post-pledge drive edition of On Your Money, devoting the entire hour to your personal finance questions as a thank you for your support from our just concluded fall membership drive. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin, or send an email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mary in Milwaukee is with us next. Hello, Mary.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin. I'm planning on getting a more fuel-efficient car in 2013, and I'm interested in a hybrid or ideally a plug-in hybrid model. Because the plug-in particularly is newer technology, I feel a little reserved about purchasing outright, and that's why I've considered leasing for a few years. Can you tell me any advantages or disadvantages of leasing?
No, I think that's actually a great idea. As long as you are completely aware of all the details and the ins and outs of the contract, many people err on the side of ignorance when they lease a car. They say, "Well, I don't need a down payment, and the overall payment is lower, and so I can just get a lease." And it's actually a good idea if you're very savvy about the details of the lease, meaning you know not only what the price of the car is, and you've negotiated that as low as you possibly can, but you also know the interest rate, because you are borrowing money on a lease. And most importantly, in your case, Mary, you know what happens at the end of the lease and how you may be hurt if you try to get out of the lease early. And in most automobile leases still, there's actually an advantage to the side of the purchaser, meaning that when you buy the lease, there's a residual value in the car, and that's going to be the price of the car when the lease is done if you want to purchase it. And the higher that value is, the less likely it is that you are going to purchase it, but the lower your lease payment's going to be. So dealers have an incentive to try to raise that up. But on the other hand, if they raise it up, you know, too high, they might be stuck with a car that costs them more at that point than what similar models would be selling for in the used market. So, no, I think it can be a very savvy move. And the nice thing about the lease, too, is because cars are generally so reliable and are covered under a warranty, you've really fixed your car cost. Once you take out a lease, you say, I can understand this is a $350 a month payment or whatever. You've really capped your monthly transportation expenses other than gas, which if you get a hybrid are going to be quite a bit lower. So for people who live on a fixed income or people who don't have a ton of extra cash around to cover emergency expenses and repairs, leasing can be a really good idea.
All right, Mary, good luck to you. Thanks for the call. Well, here's an email from Victor who asks, Lending Club is a website that allows you to buy small portions of loans to create a portfolio of loans. I see them in magazines all the time, but then there was also Bernie Madoff. Are they legit?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that just seeing something in a magazine is not the best arbiter of if something is legit or not. But I also think that this is something that bears monitoring and watching for both borrowers and lenders. And it depends on how you define legit. Lending Club is a real business. Other ones like Prosper, and there are a few smaller startups, are what are known as peer-to-peer lenders, meaning that individuals are borrowing from and lending money to other individuals with the platform basically just set up by these companies. They take a small fee to do it. You have to be eligible within certain parameters to do this, and Lending Club, only people in 42 states can actually use the services. Wisconsin is one of them, but you also have to have an adjusted gross income greater than $70,000, and you have to have a liquid net worth greater than that amount, too, and you have to agree to not purchase more than 10% of your net worth in the form of these loans. But Lending Club has a bunch of stats on their site, which I think they've done almost $1 billion worth of loans, and I think they claim that it's something like a 15% annual return on a payoff for those, and it should be treated like any other investment for better or for worse.
So yeah, it sounds like Victor is or wants to be a lender. What should lenders like Victor know?
Many of these companies do actually do some form of screening. As a matter of fact, Lending Club claims that only 1 out of 10 dollars applied for are actually accepted. And in the portfolios, it's spread out over many other different borrowers. So if something bad happens to one person, allegedly, you know, that's only going to affect a small slice of the loan portfolio, so you won't be hurt as poorly. The bad news is there are fees to this. You do not know the people to whom, you can't judge the character. It's not your brother-in-law, your neighbor, for better or for worse. And as part of that diversification, most of these loans usually go to pay off credit cards, and people realize that they're paying 28% on credit cards. If they can get a loan through this service, they might only pay 15%. So they save some money in the time. So it's actually, if everything works out okay, it's not a bad deal. The worst part about this, though, is it's highly illiquid. Typically, when you commit to a loan term, it's almost impossible to get your share of the money out if you should need it. So it's definitely not something that you would want to lock up a significant portion of your savings.
So is there a place at all for these types of loans in a person's portfolio?
I don't mind it for a small part. Keep in mind, if you are getting higher return on anything, you are taking more risk. And sometimes by definition, people who need income can't afford to take the risk because they're on a fixed income, they're retired, their nest egg is all they're going to have, so they can't afford to risk it to get this. And you might use the equivalent of maybe, you know, like a high-yield bond mutual fund, which pays more but has more risk to it. You really have to understand completely what you're getting into on this. This is one of those types of situations where we hear a lot about people who, you know, like these crowdsourcing deals where individuals can come together and they get mad when the government or the regulators get involved in it. And they say, you know, keep the government out of this. This is going really well. That's like just about anything else. It always works until it doesn't. And then a lot of times the same people turn around to the government and the regulators and say, where were you protecting me? Isn't that your job? You were supposed to protect me. So I'd rather have them be the individuals be extremely cautious about this and read all the documents, understand them completely. You might even, you know, if you're going to put a lot of money in this, it might be worth it to have a lawyer look the document over and make sure that the lawyer can interpret the document so that you understand it. And finally, like most higher reward, higher risk ventures, ask yourself, if I get nothing back from this, will I be damaged financially? And if you do get something back and it works out as you hope, be pleasantly surprised.
Back now to the phones for financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our next caller is Barb in Superior. Hi, Barb.
Hi, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Say, I have a question. I will be closing on a property I'm selling this week. And with the proceeds, I would like to gift my son, who's an adult, $5,000. Is there a tax advantage for me on this?
Generally not. And in fact, if you give too much, it can become a tax liability for you. The IRS allows individuals to give up to $13,000 generally to any other person with no gift tax incurred. But if you go over that, you usually have to file a gift tax return, and you still won't owe a gift tax, but you do have to note it in your records through this gift tax return. So you can get, the good news is you can give this money. The bad news is no, there's no tax break to doing it. I mean, some people do this, Barb, so that if they think they'll have a taxable estate at some point in the future through estate taxes, that they'll give the money away now. You can generally do that. Other people do it to try to impoverish themselves so they can hopefully qualify for public assistance if they go to nursing home. That's a little trickier to do, and it takes a long time to actually get the money out of the look-back period for many of these nursing homes. So if you want to give them the money, it's a very generous gift, but no, there really will be no tax advantage for you to doing so.
Thank you, Barb, and congratulations on the sale. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Give me some money. Give me some money.
Well, as a thank you to you for your support and lots of pledges during our fall membership drive, this is an all-questions-answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And if you have a question for Kevin, please call 1-800-642-1234. You can also email your question on your money at WPR.org. Here's an email from Ashley. She asks, Kevin, what are your thoughts on President Obama's public service loan forgiveness program? I am eligible under this program to pay a monthly minimum on my student loans and then have the remainder forgiven for after 10 years of working for a nonprofit or government organization. However, I am a little worried that with any political changes, this program may not be there in 10 years. I am thinking maybe I should invest the money I would have paid toward the loans over the next 10 years and have something saved up just in case. What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, it's one of several loan forgiveness programs that have been around for decades, and there are various forms. Some are, you know, you work in a disadvantaged area. Other ones, you work in the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps or whatever. FinAid.org has a really great listing of not only the different programs but also a breakdown of them. FinAid.org, and we'll have that link up at onyourmoney.com for people who aren't familiar with these yet and would like to know more about all these different forgiveness programs out there. It's best resource I found for this.
So should Ashley be afraid of getting this loan, and then should she be afraid that the loan could get called in?
She should be concerned about it, in part because, you know, debt forgiveness programs are really great, but someone has to pay for them. And in austere times, many times it's difficult to find the money for people who are willing to offset the money that went for her college tuition and living expenses, et cetera. So I would, if I were her, I would check the fine print of the program and see under what conditions it can be called. There could be changes to the program itself. There could be changes to the political ties to the program as well. And I think this is probably more common. There could be changes in Ashley's life. She might be part of a program and going through a loan forgiveness process over, you know, a decade or more. And all of a sudden, life might change for her. The program might go away, or she might decide she wants to do something different. So it's safer to assume that she may have to pay that loan back sooner rather than later. So to set it money aside now is a great idea. And then if it all works out as she's planned, she'll have a nice little stash of cash waiting for her at the end of her commitment.
Well, what should she be doing with her rainy day savings in the meantime?
She definitely needs to keep this liquid, so she should not worry about the return on her money. She should worry about the return of her money when she's choosing an investment. That savings account, CDs, and again, those savings bonds to which we referred earlier. Maybe if she's in a higher income bracket and she can use a pre-tax retirement plan, it might be worth it to get the tax break by saving in a 403B or 401K if she qualifies. But only if she can get at that money in a hurry through a loan with relatively little friction, because, like I said, there's a decent chance she might get that loan called in for whatever reason. And only if she really has built up enough where she can get off of this if she needs to in a heartbeat. So she should keep her options open, but otherwise just assume that it is going to get called early and plan accordingly.
Back to the phones now. Rachel in Stevens Point is with us now. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling on my way back to school. I'm a full-time student at UW Stevens Point, but I'm also a musician and photographer outside of school, and I find myself, it's a little hard to balance all of it, and I'm really seriously considering going out.
Oh, I'm so sorry. We're really losing her on the cell phone. Busy, busy person with working and going to school, and I think she wants to know if she should drop her credit load. Let's see if we can get any more. Rachel, are you still there? Well, she wants to drop back to a half-time course load. That would keep her in school longer, I suppose, and that would rack up more costs, I suppose. What do you make of that, Kevin?
Well, and especially when, you know, and I have a daughter who I think is going to be making this same phone call in about 10 years, but she's entering, you know, the high-paying world of photography and musicianship. I get that, and I think people should pursue their passions, but the part about dropping the credits or dropping the course load that bothers me is not the credits. It's the fact that, as we've mentioned, living expenses are the same whether you're taking one credit or 18 credits. And so I do encourage people, if they are struggling, to take as many credits as you can get so you can get out. And if you have to build up loans to do that, so be it. But once you kind of get out, then you can get your life going. And if you are in a major that provides some kind of employment, the quicker you get out, the more likely it is you're going to be able to start paying back those loans. But dropping it down on the half credit is really tough, unless there's some, you know, if there's a 30-hour-a-week job or something that someone like Rachel can get and make, you know, a decent amount of money, 10 to 12 bucks an hour, that's different, because then that helps offset all the living expenses, whatever. But otherwise, just kicking the can down the road. And I was in the same situation when I was in school where, you know, it just didn't, wasn't clicking for me, and it seemed like a waste of time. And then the light bulb went off, and I think I took 47 credits in a 12-month period while I was working 20 or 30 hours a week at the same time, and got out. And one of the hardest years of my life, but one of the best years of my life, because I was able to do that. So I would encourage Rachel to hang in, take as many credits as she can possibly stand, and get through this rather than delaying the inevitable.
Here's an email from Lauren, who writes, "My wife and I have a 4-month-old daughter." Well, congratulations. He wants to know, what is the best way to invest for her future? A minor savings account, a CD, a mutual fund, or another option?
No, maybe, and probably. Definitely not with a minor account. When you put money into a kid's name, that technically is the kid's money, and the parent or grandparent usually is the custodian of the account, but you're using the kid's Social Security number, so it is the kid's money, and he or she will not only be penalized by the expected family contribution when the kid goes to college if that money is in his or her name, but it is his or her money, and kids can do with it whatever they want once they reach the age of majority, and that's usually an age at which they're not making the best decisions. So sometimes they can do the wrong things with that money. If you want to focus on college, I would prefer the 529 college savings plan. Otherwise, if you want to kill two proverbial personal financial stones with $1, use a Roth IRA for yourselves, and then you're saving for retirement. And if you need the money for the daughter's college, you can pull it out, pull the contributions out tax-free at any time with no penalties whatsoever. But since you can borrow money to go to college, you cannot borrow money to go to retirement. It's best to prioritize retirement savings first.
Our next caller is Mike in Dodgeville. Hello, Mike.
Good morning. I have a quick question. Earlier, we were talking about HSAs, and you were talking about retirement. And if I understood you correctly, you said make sure that you fully fund your 401k first and then worry about an HSA. And yet, I don't see the correlation between the two. I mean, you're going to need health insurance, and you're going to need to retire. It's, in my eyes, I guess they're two separate issues.
Well, you're correct. They are two separate issues, except it's all expenses. You're either going to pay for, you know, you're going to pay for health care, or you're going to pay for health insurance, or you're going to pay for retirement in the future. The fact that HSAs allow you to not only save money on the form of a lower premium health insurance, but also save on taxes because you're making pre-tax contributions. In the case of some people, it's better for them to just to reduce their health insurance premiums and their taxes by using an HSA rather than using a 401k solely, because if they choose that instead of the high deductible plan, they'll have higher health insurance premiums. Now, the money in the retirement plan, it generally is more flexible, and because you're probably not going to use it for a long time, you can invest for the long term. With HSAs, you're more likely to be using that money in the near term, so you can't afford to take as much risk. Therefore, you probably won't have as much long-term growth. So for it still can be a nice kind of a Swiss Army knife, if you will, of an investment for people who are concerned about either trying to save for retirement or cut their health care costs. But I would prefer what you said, that you focus on each one individually, but many people don't have that luxury.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Now we go to Sue in La Crosse. Hello, Sue.
Hello. My husband is going to retire in about 6 years, and we have a good bit of money in his 401k at his work, but we were thinking of taking some out and putting it into an annuity through someone else because they guarantee that it will not go down, and the markets may go down in 6 years, and we lose quite a bit. So what would your suggestion be there?
I would suggest you read every single word of that 262-page prospectus, Sue, that you were hopefully handed by the person trying to sell you that annuity. And what you will find once you go through there is that there actually is no guarantee that the money will not go down, especially if there is some kind of provision that that it will also go up in good times. What they, and this is a very common misconception, either through the people selling these or through the people buying these, but there are these guaranteed minimum income withdrawals. They have all these step-up basis, and you can pull a little bit out. But if you wait, then you pay this extra fee, and then the dollar goes up, but it never goes down. But there's nothing in there that says you will get all the upside of the stock market and none of the downside, especially if you need to pull the money out before the guaranteed minimum income period has either begun or has completed. So there are some guarantees. I do like what you said about putting some of the money in rather than not your entire nest egg into an account like this. But I would be very conscious of the cost of this, because I think we're going to be in a very low return environment going forward. Annuities typically have higher expenses than most other retail investments out there. And if we're in a low return environment, those expenses eat up a great portion of the possible return. And so I would be very cautious about putting a lot of money into this, especially if you don't completely understand what's going on and with the mechanics of it. Otherwise, you may be better off, like I said, just in a CD rather than trying to get have your cake and eat it too, if you will.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sue. Here's a good one, Kevin. John emails, "I've listened to your show and take Kevin's advice seriously." Do you believe it?
Oh, no. I'm nervous. I didn't know that was occurring. I'm going to have to start researching some of these answers.
He goes on, "We are in our early 60s and have a small mortgage on our home. We decided to refinance instead of paying off the debt. We chose a low-rate 30-year fixed as opposed to our current 15. There's about a $300 difference between the two. We plan on placing that in our Roth. We can easily afford the new house payment. But we were at a party last weekend, and I tried to explain this logic. My friends thought we were nuts," in big capital letters. "I just didn't do a very good job with the logic. Could you help me restate that, please?"
Well, your friends may be right. You may be nuts, indeed. Who would know better than your friends, quite frankly? And especially if you're at a party and you've had a drink or two and, you know, your inhibitions have been loosened, you could indeed be nuts. I personally don't think that would be exemplified by your actions. I do think it's very smart to borrow as much as the lender will allow for 30 years and then pay it down as slowly as possible, because generally there is no penalty to do that, but it gives you access to the money and at an extremely low interest rate that is potentially tax deductible for many people. So it's better, it's actually safer. And I know I've done this for my 24th anniversary as an advisor was a week ago, so I know a little bit about what I'm talking about. It is safer to have the mortgage and the money than it is to have no mortgage but no money. The only time I would tell people that they should not get a new mortgage is, first of all, if they can't. Second of all, if they know themselves well enough to say, if I put this money aside, I'll spend it on stuff that I'll regret over the next 30 years or 30 days or whatever. So I'm just going to keep clicking right along with my mortgage payment and doing what I'm doing. But otherwise, and if you'd like, John, next time the same group is together at a party, invite me along and I'll just, you know, get up and do 20 minutes of material for you. And then hopefully everyone will understand and appreciate your gesture.
That'd be fun. We could do On Your Money from party settings. Wouldn't that be fun?
Let's do that. I think I've been, you know, kind of lusting after a motorhome for a while. So let's get the On Your Money on the road tour going on, where we'll, you know, just when we see a large group of cars parked at a home on a Saturday night, we'll just pull in, drive up on the lawn, slam the brakes on, and kick the door down and start talking about Roth IRA.
Yeah, there we go. One of these days, one of these weeks. We have time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, AssetBuilders.org is a Wisconsin-based nonprofit that sponsors several different financial literacy initiatives around the state. And one of the ones that they're doing is they're having a conference in the Fox Cities area on November 3rd, on Saturday, at the Technical College there. Most of the programs are free, and I will actually be speaking at this program November 3rd. AssetBuilders.org will have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. Well, I know you're off next week, right, Kevin?
I'm way off next week.
Enjoy your week off the radio show. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.